A 9-year-old boy sat in a Detroit ghetto in 1968, watching Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral on television. As the camera panned across Ebenezer Baptist Church, something shifted in his understanding, a dawning awareness of what it meant to be Black in America. James Baldwin was there too, later calling it the most real church service I've ever sat through. 5 years earlier, Baldwin had walked into a room with Attorney General Robert Kennedy and shattered the careful distance white liberals maintained from Black suffering. That confrontation, largely forgotten by history, revealed something essential about how power responds when it finally hears unfiltered truth. May 1963 was a pivotal year. Birmingham streets ran with water from fire hoses turned on peaceful protesters. Bull Connor's dogs tore at children's clothes. The Kennedy administration watched nervously, caught between Southern segregationists and an increasingly impatient civil rights movement. Bobby Kennedy thought he understood the problem. He'd helped broker the Birmingham resolution, appointed some progressive judges, and believed himself an ally. When he arranged to meet Baldwin, he expected a productive policy discussion. Instead, he got something far more uncomfortable: witness. Baldwin assembled an extraordinary group, not Kennedy's usual civil rights contacts, but independent voices owing nothing to political expediency. Harry Belafonte brought chart-topping fame and radical politics. Lena Horne wielded her beauty as activism. Lorraine Hansberry, fresh from A Raisin in the Sun, understood capitalism's crushing weight on Black working-class dreams. Kenneth Clark, the scholar-activist whose doll test revealed racism's psychological wounds, had provided empirical foundation for Brown v. Board of Education. Yet Jerome Smith mattered most, a freedom rider in town for medical treatment after brutal beatings. His suffering commanded respect. His presence made everything real. Kennedy tried establishing credibility, mentioning his work with Martin Luther King Jr. The room erupted in bitter laughter. They knew the truth: the phone taps, the calculated distance, the political maneuvering. For 3 hours, Kennedy mostly listened, appearing increasingly dazed as his assumptions crumbled. Clark later called it one of the most violent, emotional verbal assaults he'd witnessed. They hammered Kennedy about Northern liberal hypocrisy, how Boston's segregation mirrored Birmingham's. They exposed crushing economic despair, the Kennedys' duplicity in courting Black voters while appeasing Southern Democrats. They unmasked his privilege with surgical precision. Kennedy's immediate reaction revealed wounded pride. He hurled homophobic slurs at Baldwin and dismissed the successful Black attendees as having complexes, a defense to avoid confronting his shattered worldview. He called Baldwin a nut and vindictively had the FBI collect information on attendees, adding them to surveillance lists. Yet something profound had shifted. As Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach noted, the fact that he thought he knew so much and learned he didn't was important. Kennedy gradually transformed resentment into resolve, implementing substantial changes in Justice Department hiring and pushing his brother towards stronger civil rights legislation. In a remarkable evolution, he later confessed he might react exactly like Jerome Smith if he'd endured similar trauma. He'd made the psychological leap from contempt to identification, understanding through empathy rather than policy abstraction. This transformation reveals an enduring tension: whether change comes through government policy or ethical witness outside the system. The meeting exposed Kennedy's unwillingness to simply bear witness to Black suffering before rushing to policy solutions. The activists demanded acknowledgement of their lived experiences: the lynchings, poverty, disenfranchisement, daily humiliations that policy alone couldn't address. This confrontation replayed in 2015, when Hillary Clinton met Black Lives Matter activists. When Julius Jones asked what had changed in her heart regarding anti-Blackness, she responded, "I don't believe you can change hearts. I believe you change laws, allocation of resources, the way systems operate." The same policy-focused approach Kennedy had taken with Baldwin's group unchanged across generations. Black Lives Matter emerged after George Zimmerman's acquittal and Trayvon Martin's killing. Three black women created #BlackLivesMatter to address root causes of black suffering. They faced predictable backlash, labeled a racist and terrorist organization. Unlike Parkland students who received celebrity funding and widespread support for gun control activism, BLM activists were roundly condemned and broadly resisted. Witness is racialized. Black witness is never seen as legitimate, but rather as unjustified rage. When Colin Kaepernick knelt during the national anthem to protest police brutality, he faced charges of being un-American and ungrateful. His protest showed how black athletes translate black aspirations to broader society. As King told baseball star Don Newcomb, "You'll never know how easy you and Jackie and Dobie and Campy made it for me to do my job by what you did on the baseball field." Black Panther offers multidimensional blackness, simultaneously Afrofuturistic, Afro-Gnostic, Afro-Pessimistic, Afro-Realistic, and Afro-Idealistic. Chadwick Boseman faced the same dilemmas Harry Belafonte encountered 50 years earlier, rejecting a role after discovering his character couldn't read, drive, or swim, despite supposedly being street smart. Black audiences turned screenings into celebratory communal experiences, carnival in the best sense. Jordan Peele's Get Out became a language for racial demystification, using horror to decode blackness and decipher whiteness's arcane horrors. The film portrays the black body as host for symbiotic whiteness, beginning with a black man walking through suburbs, deliberately evoking Trayvon Martin so everybody watching the movie is black. The sunken place symbolizes silencing black voices, our greatest weapon against injustice. Wakanda exists because what should be real, justice, truth, love, isn't here. White Americans already have their Wakanda in democracy, where whiteness exists as invisible default. We return to Wakanda because it celebrates our blackness without apology. There, microaggressions die. Wakanda proves black films can succeed universally, that black superheroes can be loved, that white audiences can watch us just as we watch them. Bobby Kennedy's 1968 assassination crystallized his evolution into a racial healer. His journey began with skepticism at that 1963 meeting, struggling to grasp Baldwin's perspective on American racism. Through travels to Bedford-Stuyvesant, the Mississippi Delta, and Native American reservations, Kennedy witnessed the devastating reality of poverty and systemic racism. King's assassination in April 1968 proved pivotal. Speaking to a predominantly black crowd in Indianapolis that night, Kennedy delivered an impromptu speech revealing his transformed consciousness. Drawing from his own brother's murder, he spoke with raw emotion about compassion across racial lines. Indianapolis remained calm while other cities erupted. His martyrdom 2 months later elevated him into a symbol of what might have been, a leader who learned to listen and evolved from privileged detachment to genuine engagement. That meeting taught Kennedy about bearing witness to pain and embracing uncomfortable dialogue. His transformation from skeptic to advocate shows how exposure to different perspectives can reshape one's moral compass. Yet we still choose between policy discussions that avoid painful truths and the harder work of genuine witness, sitting with discomfort, allowing assumptions to crumble, seeking transformation through empathy rather than transaction through legislation. Truth sounds like rage to those who've never had to scream, like ingratitude to those who mistake crumbs for banquets. But to those who finally hear it, really hear it, truth sounds like the beginning of something essential, the painful, necessary work of becoming fully human together.